Welcome to Honorverse Today, the Honor Harrington podcast brought to you by TPE Network. Let's be about it.
Hello there, Honorverse fans. Welcome to yet another exciting and actually geek-filled episode of Honorverse Today. This is Raul Wibera, and I am joined, as always, by my good friends Jim Arrowwood and J.P. Harvey. How are the two of you this fine day?
Doing great.
Happy to get geeky.
Oh, yeah. And this is definitely going to be a book to geek out over, I think, in some ways. Though, I don't know, in some ways, it's a reading geek rather than a talking geek. And folks will understand that as we get into the content.
As we talk about it.
Yep, as we talk about it. I have to say, this is a very, very, very sad book for me, though. It's kind of the end of the currently published Honorverse books after a very, very long journey. Now, yeah, I know there's more coming, but the nearest one is coming out. We're in spring of 26 as we record. For those who might be listening a few years from now when you discover this podcast doing a reread or something like that. But the next book is out in June, so there's going to be a little bit of gap. And I know there's plenty of other books still coming, and hopefully some more interviews with Mr. Weber. And we've got some short stories that are available in a variety of sources that we might talk about as well in a special. But still, there's that sadness of that long journey reaching its point. Well, that said, what we are talking about this fine day is a book called The House of Steel. And it's entirely possible that some of our listeners may not have even heard of this book. This is a fine little book that didn't get a whole lot of attention because it's what's called a companion book. And there were going to be three of these, one for Manticore, one for Haven, one for the Solarian League, I believe it was. And the project got side-canned, unfortunately, after this first book. But
what we got is pretty cool.
It is, exactly. It is very much a fantastic book that any Honorverse fan will really want to have in their library. And this is a case where I would also suggest, if you can read the book on an iPad or you've got something that's a larger screen, high-res type screen, you'll be fine. But there are a bunch of color images. So if you're on a Kindle Paperwhite, when you hit things like all the pictures of the flags and the ships and the uniforms, and all of those little goodies, you know, all of those little graphical goodies, it might not be as much fun as, like I said, either an iPad or a laptop or, hey, good old-fashioned hard copy. So, Jim, I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to you for a summary.
Okay, fair enough. So, from the back of the book, The Ultimate Guide and Companion to the New York Times Best-Selling Honor Harrington Series. This contains a new short Honorverse novel, plus a compendium of technology, specifications, and history to accompany the legendary series. An all-new David Weber short novel, I Will Build My House of Steel, chronicling the early days of the Manticoran Star Kingdom when King Roger was a naval lieutenant. Have you ever finished the latest Honor Harrington novel from David Weber and wished you could linger in Weber's Honorverse just a bit longer? Now you can, with this treasure trove of texts, specs, and insights on David Weber's mega best-selling Honor Harrington series. Orbital characteristics of key planets, regimental order of the Royal Navy, backstory on the history and drama of the Star Kingdom's birth and early days, you'll find it all here. Thoughtfully arranged by the Bureau 9 Weber Research Group and overseen by David Weber himself. Well, there it is.
Hey, and I got to give credit to whoever wrote that back cover. They called it right, a short novel, not a short story or a novella like mega best-selling authors have referred to it as.
Mm-hmm.
Though for David, I guess, a couple hundred pages is a short story.
Yeah. It was about a third. It was about a third of the
book. I'm teasing you, David. You know how much we love you, guy.
Yeah. So, and then you mentioned how the other two companions didn't get done. I have to wonder if that wasn't because of how much work it is to do something like this.
It had to be a ton.
That is a very fair point because, it's when you look at the content in there, it's massive.
Yes.
I mean, the book isn't terribly long, but the content is detailed, dense. And we'll get into that when we get to that section of the book because we're taking a little bit of an unusual approach there.
Yeah. All right. So, hey, how about we bounce it over to JP for his special notes?
All right. A few nuggets about the book. This is a unique book within the Honorverse, as you're hearing. 565 pages published by Ban in May of 2013. You'll notice we violated our rule that we'll read and discuss the books in their publication order. In this case, this book was marketed as a companion, although the first third of the book is a novella, short novel, long short story, however you want to characterize it. You can decide. The novella essentially provides us a narrative biography of King Roger III, titled, as you heard, I Will Build My House of Steel, giving us the title of the whole volume. The events in the story take place between 1844 and 1914 PD. The remainder of the book, after that, is a detailed companion full of history, military info, political and governmental info, ship classes, uniforms, just so much more. It's a fantastic and robust source of information about an incredible variety of things found throughout the Honorverse. The decision to discuss this book out of publication order is due to most of the book being that companion. And with that, we ought to probably jump right into overall impressions, and I'm going to hand back to you, Jim.
All right. So I Will Build My House of Steel, which is the short novel, is another one of those stories where we get a retelling of things we've already read, kind of, but from another point of view. And in this case, a lot of details. Okay. While some readers don't seem to enjoy this kind of storytelling, I personally do. I like getting to know Roger and his wife, Elizabeth, Jonas, and to a lesser degree, Michael. I also enjoyed the story of the battle at home on Manticore with Roger having to work so hard to make the improvements to the Royal Manticore Navy. Roger was an insightful and benevolent ruler and saw what it was going to take to maintain independence from being annexed by the People's Republic of Haven after the legislaturalists were out of business, and their aggressive expansionism. It is an enjoyable tale for those who like alternate points of view and to have some of the blanks filled in. And speaking of having blanks filled in, over to you, JP.
All right. I thought it was a cool book. I enjoyed the story, but for me, it didn't add much to what I already felt that I knew about King Roger III and the circumstances of his reign. That said, don't get me wrong. There was some new info in there for sure. Like you said, Jim, details in there and certainly new perspectives, but I was already honestly pretty content with what I knew about these events. Even so, the novella was time well spent. It wasn't a chore to get through, and I didn't regret reading it when I got done with it. But the biggest draw for me, honestly, was the other two thirds of the book, that companion. And that probably, honestly, it shaded my interest in the in the first part of the book because I was very eager to get to the details of the companion. Raul.
I do have to mention something out of order from my notes, and it's based on what you've said, is that two-thirds, if you liked those afterwards on the history or the Navy or the development of technology, you know, things like that in the novels, House of Steel is a must read for you. So if you like those geeky, if you really like digging into those geeky aspects and really want to know the depth of what's going on inside and some of the whys, this is definitely the book for you. To my main thoughts regarding the short story, David calls this a novella. Yeah. And like I said earlier, for anyone else, this is a short novel. And like JP said, on the one hand, it really doesn't add a lot in the way of what, if you've read the other books, and especially if you've read the short stories, because Honor Harrington, the second anthology published in 99, has the story Queen's Gambit from Jane Linscold. And it's largely Elizabeth's perspective and her husband's investigation into the murder and how all of this was found out. So in a way, it doesn't add much in the way of what. However, it does have a lot about the why and how of the events and history as we know it. And another aspect of it is we actually see the events, technically Roger Winton's point of view, but it really is, his view really is Elizabeth's perspective as well. Elizabeth was absolutely a daddy's girl, no doubt about that, in the best possible way. So while we've seen the story of Roger's assassination, Elizabeth's rise to the throne, seeing her father's history as well as the bond between the dynamic and of father and daughter, you really understand just the depth of hatred Elizabeth has for the peeps in a way you wouldn't have understood without reading the story. Overall, I consider this a very good read, but a read that's more at a digested pace, and it's worth every moment you give it. So, Jim, I'm going to pass it back to you, sir.
All right, fair enough. So, the elements of the story. Now, we've done this a little differently. We're going to do the story, then we're going to talk about the companion briefly. So, here's the story. I will build my house of steel. The first third of the book is a story chronicling the life of King Roger III, Queen Elizabeth III's father and mentor. The story opens with a bit of stage setting in the form of a note from Sir Donald Kegan Morrison, thanking Elizabeth for the opportunity to write Roger's story and his instrumental role of building the Royal Manticore and Navy, which is long past due in 1921 PD. What immediately follows is a pair of short articles from opposing viewpoints of the strength and readiness of the Royal Manticore and Navy. In 1844 PD, Captain Edward Janacek argues his position that the Royal Manticore and Navy is adequate for the defense of the Manticore system as it stands, and the expense of expanding the Navy beyond its current strength would be expensive and unnecessary. On the other hand, Crown Prince Roger, first officer of the HMS Wolverine, writes about how the Navy needs to develop beyond its current strength, especially needing an expansion of its wall of battle and weaponry.
Janacek was an ass even before the main series.
Well,
I almost used a word you would have had to cut.
Once and always? No. I guess.
Yeah.
You know? So a couple of a little bit of ground laying stuff going on there. All right. And so now the rest of this I broke down into periods of time. So this is 1850 to 1852 PD. Roger is concerned with changes in the People's Republic of Haven. He observes their rapid building up of their navy and how they have become expansionist by annexing many star systems. They move closer to Manticore, and Roger convinces his mother, Queen Samantha II, that he should be transferred to the Bureau of Weapons to work on research and development to improve their weaponry. After a discussion with 4th Space Lord Lomax, Roger is granted the appointment, and he meets Commander Jonas Adcock. They soon become friends, and they go to work despite being hamstrung by the current Navy administration. Jonas introduces Roger to his sister, Angelique. Roger is immediately infatuated with her. Later, in a meeting with Samantha and others who control spending from the Royal Manticore Navy, Roger tries to convince them there needs to be more money into the Bureau of Weapons programs. Roger also notices how his mother is aging, and Samantha tells him he will be taking over the reins of state soon, and he should settle down and marry Angelique.
Nothing like having your family tell you how it should be, right? Especially your sister.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And what's funny, at first I was expecting Lomax to more or less give him the boot. And then the way she kind of went, okay, we got another one of these, and introduces him to Adcock was just funny.
Yeah. Well, see, one of the things, though, that was stressed, I thought, in this story is that there was no way anybody was going to turn Roger down on his transfer because he is the crown prince, and that's where he wants to be, and it doesn't, and so that's the way it's going to be.
One of the things else that this section of the story kind of was, well, I don't know, it's like almost sad or just struck me as awfully narrow, was the way so little had changed from the period of
Travis.
Yeah, Travis Long. Now I can say it. One of the
we saw this fight happening then as well, and then it appears nothing changed.
It appears nothing has changed in a few centuries, which is kind of sad. Though the flip side of it is also Haven has gone from one of Manticore's closest allies to one of their most feared aggressors.
Yeah, they're a threat.
We are all on the same page here, because it was Jensen who was the leader.
Yeah.
And yeah, all this fits together. So yeah, this would be from the period before you had a real solid kingdom, when there was so much space, who needed a real strong Navy. So,
and it comes up in this story, but they were perceived understandably as sort of a backwater nation.
Yeah.
Even though per capita, they were the richest nation in the known galaxy.
Yeah. Right. Prior to the discovery of the wormhole junction, of course.
Yeah. Well, and that becomes the other funny that we quickly jumped on to Trevor, meaning Travis, because Trevor's star is a part of this story and how the at least the Navy, but parts of the government at large realized that the potential threat that the People's Republic was becoming, a part of what makes them a threat was their ability, if they gained access to the junction at Trevor's Star, they could in one hop basically be right in Manticore's business. And it was already captured.
They
and
were
the setup
a hop away
for this
from-
was that the People's Republic was expansionist at this point.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Big time.
And it wasn't just that they take Manticore and then they've got half the galaxy as their feeding grounds for their to consume economies.
Yeah.
So Travis and the time back then, they were looking at the reality of piracy being a threat and a need to better the Navy to account for that against opposition. And now here we are where they're looking at another nation that's a threat, and you see the same response in essence. Hey, what we have is good enough. There, with the pirates, it was, there aren't pirates, you know, it's almost a myth. And now here we have an ally who's become an antagonist and advocacy to change or increase the capability of the Navy, and you get that, you know, we're good. We're good with what we have. No one's going to bother us.
Yeah. All right. I'll move right along. So now we're up to 1855 to 1857 PD. Disagreement and infighting over weapons development continues while the People's Republic of Haven continues with its expansionist agenda. Roger and Angelique are to be wed. Samantha is in ill health and succumbs to her condition. Roger is soon crowned King Roger III and immediately faces strong opposition to his proposed funding increases for the Navy. He knows how the People's Republic of Haven are using strict draconian methods to maintain control of their annexed systems, and Roger believes that they have a direct threat to the Kingdom of Manticore, especially at Basilisk and the nearby Wormhole Junction. He is also faced with other problems like stopping corruption in his own kingdom. Roger appoints Jonas command of a secret weapons program called Gram. He further promises Gram will be funded no matter how it's done. His cabinet pledge their loyalty and promise the king their best efforts to support him. Comments?
Well, good background and development material.
Yeah. Sad. Very sad. Mm-hmm.
And a cool way to bring Basilisk into the equation or back into our memories. Because that's how the whole thing kicked off back with the very first book.
I was going to ask, is my understanding that this book was published on the 10th anniversary of On Basilisk Station?
No, 2013.
Okay.
Basilisk Station was in 1994.
Okay, so it would be the 20th anniversary.
Yeah, really close to 20.
Thereabouts.
Yeah, because I remember seeing that mentioned somewhere. All right.
One of the things I started noticing and liking, and especially in this section, is we start seeing some, I'll say it in advance, the characters section is kind of short. And it's because they're characters we've seen so much before. But we're seeing these a lot of our old favorite characters and some of our not so favorite characters, 50 years younger, 40 years younger, which is cool.
Yeah.
Two in particular, you know, fan favorites of the Alexander brothers and Hamish in particular, and then Sonya Hemphill on the other side, who turns out not to be so horrible of a person, but there's a reason that her nickname was Horrible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Shall I move on?
Yes, sir. Go fast.
All right. So this is 1865 to 1870 PD. Crowned Princess Elizabeth is born. There is a lot of political maneuvering taking place in attempts to keep the peace, but everyone knows the People's Republic and the Kingdom of Manticore are the two biggest entities on the playground, and eventually there's going to be a fight. One thing Roger does is appoint young Elizabeth the Duchess of Basilisk in order to keep the People's Republic and others from coming too close to the kingdom. During Elizabeth's fourth birthday celebration, Roger and Jonas discuss the development of a laser head and how it must remain secret for the time being. Understanding how the People's Republic of Haven Navy would react should they learn of it. Roger also wants to promote Jonas to admiral, but Jonas refuses the promotion to be sure that the Gram project isn't compromised. Roger tells him he will have to step up into the big picture one day and accept promotion.
I felt like I was seeing a little Captain Kirk there, right? When they want to promote him to admiral. I can't remember when that part of the Star Trek storyline unfolds. And he's like, no, I don't want to be an admiral because I'm a really good captain and I need to do captain things. And not exactly the same character, not a carbon copy, but it was interesting to see that offer of admiral put on the table, and he's like, don't do that.
Yeah.
Leave me where I am.
Well, and because he was doing his cowboy thing out there among the stars. And that's right. That's what he wanted to be doing. And you might also recall that in the movie, where the Nexus is, where they go into the different timelines and weird stuff, Kirk tells Picard, don't let them promote you. Don't let them take you off the bridge of that ship. So, yeah. I think Jonas's reasons are a little bit different, though.
I do too.
Yeah. So, but it is a parallel. All right, moving along. 1877 to 1883 PD. Debate on whether it is better to pursue diplomatic options or to have a stronger military are in the public sector. Some think that both are good options when one considers having a strong military to back up diplomatic efforts. King Roger decides there needs to be a permanent military presence at the wormhole terminus at Basilisk. Elizabeth turns 12 and shows an interest in her future duties as queen. Mostly, she wants to help her dad, who appears to be carrying a lot of burden most of the time. Roger assures her she will be more involved as time moves forward. He begins training her in her royal duties. Later, Roger takes Elizabeth to a conference where Jonas is awaiting their arrival. The discussion focuses on the People's Republic of Haven's intention to annex the Trevor Star system soon and how Roger plans to deal with that. Roger is planning to go to San Martin to propose a mutual defense treaty to defend the wormhole terminus there. Angry, Roger declares if the peeps want a war, Manticore will give them one. Jonas and his people come up with a missile they need to build ships to carry. But secrecy about these new weapons is all important. Before Roger goes to San Martin, he plans a stop at the Salt Flats for some recreation. There are systems failures on Roger's grav ski, at first appearing to be an accident, but later they are found to be an assassination. There is no treaty with San Martin, and Trevor Star falls to the People's Republic. Elizabeth becomes Queen Elizabeth III, and in a fit of grief and anger, declares war with the People's Republic when she learns that they are responsible for her father's death. Elizabeth tells Jonas the people who are responsible for the assassination, but their identities cannot be revealed openly for political reason. She also tells Jonas she will be doubling the military budget and that Graham is to work twice as hard so when war happens with the People's Republic, Manticore can reduce the peep fleet to rubble.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And like I said, part of what we hear in this, especially with the death of Roger and Elizabeth first stepping in, we also got in the short story, Queen's Gambit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But
yep. Actually, much more detail there than here. This takes us back to that, you know, the assumption being people have read these stories that you're reminded pretty vividly, or I should say you're reminded of what was really a vivid description of the accident, the death of Roger, Elizabeth's ascension to the throne, and I think a pretty good level of detail of how and why she carried the anger that she did. And it really goes back, Jim, to what you said, was that she, I think you said this, Jim, maybe it was you, Raul, that she was a daddy's girl, and he began teaching her duties. And no doubt her view of the PRH was colored by Roger. So when she finds out that this was no accident, it was an amazing bit of storytelling, but also not really a surprise.
Yeah. All right. Now the story moves ahead 30 years. Hamish Alexander watches a battle unfold before him in the Barnett system. The People's Republic of Haven Navy do not understand why the Manticorans are moving into the system so slowly, but they are ready to put up a fight. the peeps continue to puzzle over the unorthodox strategy as alarms sound. They have Manticoran missiles incoming. The battle ends with not a single shot fired from the People's Republic of Haven Navy, and Hamish calls for the surrender of the enemy fleet. Admiral Thomas Caporelli tells Elizabeth they have won the war with the People's Republic of Haven thanks to the efforts of her father and those of Jonas. Elizabeth goes to King Michael's Cathedral and pays homage to Roger. And yeah, that is the story.
That was actually a neat way to wrap this one up. Yeah. We see the culmination of all of King Roger's work.
Yeah. So, Raul, you want to lead us in a discussion of characters, please?
Sure. And with the, I'm going to actually start off instead of with what I got noted. Like I said, there's not a lot because there's really only a couple truly new characters for us. But what I was surprised with was who we didn't see. The one character we didn't see that was a little bit of a surprise was No Hyridge.
Ah.
I wonder what he was doing during all this time.
Yeah.
Because, and it was, what really knocked that home was that ending, that last part, when Caporelli called Elizabeth and said, we just won the war. Well, with that attack, they pretty much had just won the war.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if we didn't have to deal, if the assassination of Cromartie and the rise of Hyridge hadn't, I mean, that's the only reason things fell apart.
And for those who may wonder where honor is in all of this, I mean, this is obviously, a lot of this is taking place ahead of her time, but as we walk through those dates, October 1857, when Roger, around the time Roger becomes King Roger III, is when Honor was born, which was actually, I think she was born in 1859, if I'm remembering right. So,
yeah,
right around that time.
She's a little bit older than Elizabeth, right?
Yeah, I think she's slightly older than Elizabeth.
And Hinky as well.
So you're getting young, relatively young Hamish Alexander, young Sonia Hemphill,
mm-hmm.
and infant Honor, not mentioned, but just so that there's a reference point for the nerds like me that wonder where all this falls in the timeline. Honor was born in the middle of all of this. So we are running up to and then seeing events that unfold very shortly after her birth.
And you know, the age resisting thing that they do.
Right. Prolong
kind of throws a wrench into figuring things out sometimes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Because there's no real world thing to compare it to yet.
You know, that was one of the things that kind of was a little bit, that was rather touching about this, is we saw characters having to deal with the loss and the issues of Prolong and watching their peers grow old and die in front of them, even though, you know, just because there was a couple years difference.
Oh, Samantha.
Yeah. And, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, well, in theory, she would have passed long before, she would have passed, even without Prolong, she would have passed before Roger, no matter what. But it was a little touching at points.
Yeah.
And you kind of forgot how old she really was at times. As far as the new characters, to move on, the two that we really see as new characters are Jonas Adcock and King Roger. And the dynamic between the two, especially, I really liked, and especially the way Adcock just did not want the limelight at all.
Yeah.
He was a tech geek.
What I like, and this is all the way through the entire book series, is that the Wintons are regular people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They don't push, you know, their thing. I mean, it's Jonas and Roger when the two of them are talking with each other. Of course, yeah, when they're in public in front of other people, they use titles. But that all gets dropped with friends and things like that. And that's been kind of a theme that's gone all the way through. The egos get set aside, and that's kind of refreshing. In the Witten
family.
That's kind of refreshing.
You know, and you hit one of my favorite plot point in one of my quotes. It's because that carried over to Elizabeth as well. It seems to be a thing with the entire Witten family.
Yeah.
And the requirement, the constitutional requirement to marry a commoner may have something to do with that, but
yeah.
How they find those commoners, though, really reflects the point that you're making.
You mean like the audition process?
No, but I mean, Roger really had a problem with getting any special treatment. It really steamed him if he got any special treatment, if they didn't look at his arguments or positions as anything but a naval officer's.
That's what he wanted to be, is a naval officer. Yeah. And by benefit of the order that the children were born in, he got stuck.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We do see, like I said, a lot of characters that we're very, very familiar with. If I went down that list, it would be too long. Two of the characters, though, that I absolutely have to call out, though, are Hamish Alexander and Sonny Hemphill. So it's like they turns out they were best enemies since kindergarten. And I love the way Sonia is described. I love the description of Sonia. And the way it's described is she's this and that. She's this and that again. She's been doing this and this and this. Oh, and that again. Basically annoying people. And did I say, and the insane bouncy enthusiasm, it's like, okay, not, you know why she gets along so well with Shannon Foraker.
Yeah.
I think more than any other story, any other book where we see her and see what she's doing, David did a really cool job, I think, here of painting ultimately what's like her prime motive. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't do it in a way that says, see, she's totally cool and everyone should have been listening to her. He puts it in context. She's the one who, and this phrase is used in the story, that's always looking for the magic bullet.
Yep.
As opposed to Hamish, who doesn't want to dismiss that, but insists on you have to use and improve on the technology you have now that is proven technology. You can't win a war based on something that you hope you have later. And in reality, what for me, I thought what David did here was show that those two are both critical. He personified a view, a perspective, a philosophy, or two of them, into these characters. And you've got them being frenemies. I like that you called them that. We need both. And he even says at one point in the story, the R&D piece, the Sonia piece, has its place. So, you know, it reinforced the don't dismiss her and what she's trying to do, even though she's a pain in the butt, because she's going to help bring things to the fight that a person like Hamish later would say, I am so glad that there were whatever the technology is. I'm so glad somebody pursued that because that helped assure the win in the war, that kind of thing. So really well done. Opinions formed about both of these characters. Sonia being, as I mentioned, the one we love to hate. But I thought he very gently put her in a good place in this.
We're getting to one of my favorite plot points. So I'll be surprised if I'm the only one. But yeah, what you're saying is right. It's the development of Sonia Hemphill was a huge part of this story.
Yeah.
All right. To move on, one question I would like to know. There are a whole lot of characters listed here with name drops, and I can't help but wonder how many of these character names are Tuckerisms.
Yeah, probably a good portion.
I'm sure. I was almost tempted to try and cross-reference the list of B9 personnel and some of the names here just to see.
Yeah.
To move on to places, things, organizations. Well, yeah, we do visit a lot of places around Manticore, but I'm not really going to bring them up because most of the story takes place in conference rooms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Or similar. Yep.
It's not necessarily an action story, but it's a background story that involves a lot of politics, a lot of political machinations. And, you know, there's an old saying about the battle, you know, the battlefield for politicians is the meeting room. Mm-hmm. So now there are some new places definitely worth mentioning. Jim had mentioned it, Graham, their new secret. Yes.
I have a question. Is Graham the impression I had, which I could be entirely mistaken, but the impression I had is that Graham was not a place as much as it was a program.
A program, organization. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't think that
hidden
was a place.
In closets, basically, around Manticore B, around Griffin.
Yeah.
But it's not a city or a planet.
No.
It's a program.
Places, it falls into the things and organizations, yeah, not so much a place. Well, it is a place. I mean, they actually had offices, but yeah, right. It's not that kind of a place. It's a special department, Black Ops. Secretly hidden, tucked away, and even when they were feeding the developments.
Cool.
Uh-huh. And for those who don't know, it is named, the name Graham is from the ancient Norse legend of Sigurd. That was his sword. I will build my house of steel, so good fitting name. And that was the sword he used to kill the dragon Fafnir. No, but we really don't have much action in the story until the end, where it kind of wraps things up with Hamish starting his attacks. What was that? The beginning of Operation Buttercup, I think?
Yeah, I didn't think about that, but probably was.
Uh-huh.
Thought I remembered Buttercup being mentioned somewhere. Oh, well.
Now, and it was cool to see how that unfolded. That was a different perspective of the fight.
Yeah.
It's one of the few times we actually get to see Hamish Alexander actually in action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Most of his military work, most of his military actions are behind the scenes, that, and we really don't see them. So that was another nice aspect of this.
Yeah. And all right. Sigurd, the Norse legend in German is Siegfried.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about Wagner's operas, the Ring des Nibelungen.
Yeah. Yeah, but we don't have 3 days to sit down and go and do that one.
3 days? It's a week, my friend. It is a week.
I thought if it was done as programmed, it was 3 nights.
There's no orchestra whose bodies can stand up to, especially the brass people. No, I don't know. I've never seen it. I've always wanted to go see The Ring, but
it's longer than a game of cricket. Is that what I mean?
It's very long. Yeah. Yes. The opera's
very long.
Each opera in itself, and there are four. Are
is it four? Like,
I think so. There's Das Rheingold, Siegfried, Die Walküre, and Gotha Dämmerung.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I've always wanted to especially see the last one, Götterdämmerung, where there's this big tree and Wotan, who is Odin in the Norse legend, Wotan goes away when the last leaf falls off of the giant tree of life. And it's quite a deal. But yeah, there's no orchestra in the world that has the kind of endurance to do two of those in one night. Anyway, that's an aside. You triggered my music stuff.
You and Anthea should have a nice little conversation about that. I got to check this out now.
Oh.
How long is Wagner's Ring Cycle? Yes, four opera, 15-hour epic, usually performed across four consecutive nights.
Yeah, so,
Total uninterrupted musical duration is around 15 hours. though with intervals, it can span up to 18 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, let's keep this moving.
Yep.
JP.
We can pass this over to JP.
Yeah, JP.
All right, some themes. Themes. There are a ton of them in this story, like a lot. And they're all themes that we've talked about before. So I'm going to highlight just a couple. And then one of these will tie to some quotes. But the first one is politics and the military. And I'm mentioning it, even though I'm going to tell you, it's kind of obvious since the story's about a member of the royal family who is also a Navy officer and who becomes the king. So, of course, politics and the military. The whole thing begins with that, with young officer Roger penning a piece for the journal called Proceedings, and then a counter argument made by Janáček. So it starts with this, essentially, politics and the military. And then from there, Roger's intent to do things with the Navy that are opposed by others. So there's that running through the whole story. And the other is economics, specifically domestic economic policy as it relates to other political policies and objectives. In this case, in the story, it's how economics relates to the building of a more capable interstellar navy and also to the international relations tied to expanding commerce as tied to the wormhole. So all of that is in play also through this entire thing. But if you go back, or for the people that geek out on this, go back and look at the themes that we've covered in the past. There's just a ton of them that are appearing dazzling through this short novel. And I'll just add here, all of that is focused primarily through the lens of Roger during his young adult years and then up to or into his reign. And then, Raoul, you mentioned this, I think, too, that we get a little bit of a view through Elizabeth's eyes as well. Mm-hmm. But those are the themes I wanted to call out: politics and the military, and then economics. How about you guys? Any others that?
It would be a callback to a lot of other things. I mean, family would be a very strong theme that we got into here.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, JP, we've been talking about this for however long we've been doing this podcast. So
yeah. But that's the themes that I want to throw out there to keep in the fronts of minds. And it might
be time.
I think
one thing, it's not exactly a theme, but one thing this book does well is pull a lot of pieces from the different series and different things together.
Yeah, and it did.
In the context of the themes, as well as just in the context of the plots.
Yeah. Well, we saw it with characters, as you talked about. We see it with locations, places, to include Basilisk and Trevor Star. And mm-hmm. Haven, and like, there is a huge amount in this short novel, novella, long short story thing. Well, how about?
So,
yeah, go.
I was going to say, so any plot points then?
Jim?
Who wants to start?
I will start. My favorite plot point was reading about the relationship between Roger and Elizabeth. She is a smart youngster who grows into a brilliant ruler as time moves forward, and Roger is an excellent father. He tries to include his daughter in what he can and is not discouraging when she cannot participate. It is plain that Elizabeth adores her dad and vice versa.
Yeah, so true.
How about you, JP?
For me, Roger's time in uniform was pretty interesting, especially since he did his best, as mentioned just a bit ago, to insist that others treat him according to his rank, not his lineage. It didn't really work, but it was, I thought, well-written, genuine humility with him and not some sort of show he was putting on to try and earn favor, or the favor, perhaps, of non-nobility. For me, that took him from being a genuine and likable character to being a very likable character. he is someone who would be easy to follow and easy to serve. And then if you pile that on top of, Jim, what you said about the father-daughter relationship and him being a good dad, man, what a cool character that Roger is.
Yep.
Yep.
Raul. Right.
I've actually got two plot points that I was really taken with. The first one we've talked about somewhat, and that was the, and we, you know what, just thinking, we really never saw it face-to-face. It was always by secondhand reports. The relationship between Sonya Hemphill and Hamish Alexander.
Yeah. Yeah. That was super cool.
The development of the Sonya's development in particular, but also the rivalry was a really fun piece of back history to get filled in. I really, really enjoyed that. I wouldn't mind seeing more stories or, shorts filling in some of those details. And, you know, when you think about it, We kind of got a hint of those possibilities with the Toll of Honor books, the Toll of Honor book, some of the one-off back history story. David, that would be a great way to let us know a little bit about what you haven't told us out of your writer's Bible. Hint, hint, hint.
We won't tell anyone else, we swear.
No, not much.
The other plot point, which was rather short, but I really liked it, was the courtship of Elizabeth and Justin. That was absolutely wonderful. It was like she messed up 3 hours of work and he ripped her a new one. And when you think of Elizabeth's temper that we've been hearing about for the last 40 books, for her to sit there and take it, it was just a blast to read.
That's love.
That was love at first sight. I've accused David of being a closet rom-com junkie in the past. And yeah, I know he's denied it, but my friend, I'm sorry. I'm going to stand by that claim.
Cool.
He wrote it well.
Yeah. We also saw with Angelique.
Yeah, Angelique.
And Roger, too, but... Okay, so Jim, I'm going to go ahead and pass it to you and we can get a start on some of our quotes.
All right, and I will go ahead and start this off. I do have one. So in a cabinet meeting where additional funding for the Royal Manticore Navy is being discussed, Jackson Denham, Baron of Seawell and Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Roger find themselves at odds. Afterwards, a meeting with Queen Samantha, there is this exchange. You did well, Roger. Very well, Samantha Winton said, sipping her tea. I was particularly impressed when you didn't reach across the table and pull his tonsils out through his nose. I thought I concealed my unhappiness rather well, actually, Mom, he replied, sitting back with a tankard of cold beer, while Monroe purred across the back of his chair. Besides, if I wanted his tonsils, I'd ask Monroe to extract them. His claws are a lot better equipped for that kind of surgery. Samantha chuckled, and Monroe reached out to smack Roger gently on top of the head with a true hand. Roger smiled, but there was a carefully hidden darkness behind that smile as he looked at his mother. She'd aged noticeably over the last couple of years, and something inside him raged at her increasing frailty. The slight bend in her spine that defied everything the doctors could do. It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. For to be visibly fading in front of him when she was barely 30 years older than he was. Don't go giving Monroe any ideas, she said sternly after a moment. Cats are very direct souls. If you give them the idea that they can go around dissecting cabinet ministers, it's going to get very messy. Not if he and I make a few salutary examples right up front, surely, Roger replied. Just one or two. I'm sure the others would get the idea and begin deferring suitability to my tyrannical whims. I wish, Samantha said. With rather less humor.
Yeah.
So how about you, JP?
I have one, and it is Roger thinking about at the time, Lieutenant Commander Hamish Alexander and Lieutenant Commander Sonia Hemphill. So our kindergarten frenemies are now naval officer equivalents. He'd pointed out more than once that the best was the worst enemy of good enough, and argued that the Navy had to build innovative tactical and operational doctrines around hardware it knew was attainable if it was going to confront an opponent like the People's Republic of Haven. It couldn't afford to depend on stumbling across some radical transformation of warfighting technology that had somehow managed to elude the rest of the galaxy for the past couple of T-centuries. Instead, as he'd told Sonia on more than one scathing occasion, the emphasis should be on improvement of known technologies. Pure speculative R&D had a place in his view, but primary emphasis should be placed on applied research to provide the greatest possible qualitative edge in existing offense and defensive systems. The problem, Roger thought, is that we need both of them, because both of them are making very valid arguments. Sonia really is too convinced she's going to come up with a silver bullet if she just throws enough ideas at the bulkhead until one of them sticks. She's not interested in how we get the best use out of the systems we've already got, because she's so confident she's going to be able to replace them with something so much better. And Hamish is too stubborn and smart and outside the loop of what we're looking at over here to pin his hopes on something that may well never materialize. No wonder the two of them are at each other's throats. Raul, your turn, my friend.
Well, I actually have two. One is a little bit shorter, and I'm going to do that first because it ties directly into your quote, JP. And then the other one is a bit of a truth statement from Into the Fire, the television show that we read about several times in Honors Day, and apparently was quite popular 50 years before. So the first one is, I think, from around the same point in the book as yours, but it's one of the conversations between Hamish and Sonia. About Hamish and Sonia. Even more unfortunately, Hamish and Sonia were already equal in rank, which took Article 20 off the table in her case. Worse, the two of them had known each other since childhood, and Roger was of the opinion that they'd probably had their first fight in a kindergarten sandbox. Be fair, he scolded himself. The real problem is that he thinks she's a panacea merchant. He's not the only one either, and the fact that she can't tell him what's really going on in Jonas's shop isn't making things any better. Whatever her other failings, she takes her security clearance and its restrictions seriously, God bless her ornery little soul, which forces her to talk in generalities rather than specifics in public. Her frustration quotient's getting bigger too, now that she sees all those tantalizing possibilities she can't talk about, which is undermining whatever effort towards tactfulness she might otherwise make. In fact, that's probably what set this one off, and in some ways I can't really blame her. But if this keeps up or gets even worse, a lot of people are going to start sharing Hamish's opinion, and that really could be a problem further down the line. And this just reminded me, that's the one she's brilliant. She's high energy. She's shown a lack of tact. She's high energy. She's effective. She's innovative. She's shown a lack of tact. Did I mention she's shown a lack of tact? That almost made it one of my quotes, and this one ended up bumping.
Well, you got it in anyway.
Yep. Okay, my second quote is a little bit longer. As I said, this is from the political commentary show Into the Fire. Part of the discussion, and it addresses a truth, and I know we've talked about this before in some of the past novels, but it addresses a basic truth that really just struck me as, yeah, this is about as well as it can be said. The most dangerous error a foreign policymaker can commit is to assume the people on the other side of a confrontation, whether it's a peaceful competition or an act of war, are just like us. That, under the surface, they share the same basic values, the same view of the galaxy. and even more dangerous, that they interpret events, relationships, and opportunities the same way we do. Because the truth is, Joe, that not everyone does, and the peeps don't. In more ways than I can count, they live in a completely different galaxy from ours simply because their starting position, their objectives, and the way they see events are so different from ours. They're perfectly capable of doing things you and I would both agree without any reservations at all, are insane given the alternatives, the advantages of dealing openly and peacefully with their interstellar neighbors. And they're capable of that because they're starting from a different place and operating under a totally different set of constraints. Constraints and objectives and beliefs which make what you and I would agree are fundamentally irrational decisions completely rational, even inevitable. You're right that it takes a big stick to allow someone to speak softly and be heard by a masked thug who makes his living through armed robbery. Unfortunately, you also have to convince the thug in question that you not only have a big stick, but that you are prepared to use it. It really struck me, there's actually a story, a short little story behind this in my past, going back to my university days. I used to be a member of an organization called the World Federalist Association, and under those auspices, I made a trip to New York City, in particular the UN. And one of the things that we did, that we got to do, was make a visit to the Soviet Union's embassy at the UN. And if you've ever dealt with anything that's actually on Soviet territory or under Soviet control, which obviously their embassy is, right? This commentary this explanation here, it just brought that memory straight up and clear into my mind, it just almost starkly. It's like, wow, this is exactly what I was thinking when I visited the Soviet embassy back in those days. So that quote just really said something to me from that kind of personal historical perspective. So that's why I had to include it. All right. I am going to go ahead and pass this. JP, you want to get us through closing thoughts and takeaways?
Yeah, it's time for that. And Jim, you want to lead the dance on this one?
All right. So I enjoyed this story as a look back into the past and to answer some questions I may have had. It was neat to see how Roger influenced the establishment of the Royal Manticoran Navy and how Elizabeth grew and became an outstanding ruler. So, yeah, I was eminently entertained.
Nice. I'll jump in. As I mentioned, this was a good story. I enjoyed it, but would have been just fine if we didn't have it. Without the novella, I think I might have appreciated the companion part of the book much earlier in this adventure. Not that it was denied to me, but you only know what you know when you know it. And having read it now, I kind of wish I had awareness of it and jumped into it much earlier in this Honorverse voyage. Raul, how about you?
Yep. I don't disagree with anything that is said here. This was a very enjoyable trip into the near past of the Honorverse. Was it absolutely necessary? No, I'll admit that. Was it worth reading? Absolutely. In fact, it's worth reading enough that it will be in the readings in chronological order when I do a reread of the Honorverse series. And that will probably start when the time skip occurs and we take up the story with her Honor's children. So, yeah. The short novel was a great addition to the motivation behind Elizabeth, as well as the political structure of the Star Kingdom. And we haven't talked about it yet, but we're about to. I'll go ahead and say it now. If you're a tech or history geek, then that companion section is absolutely something that you can and will get lost in. My biggest regret about this book is that the other two companion books were set aside. The ones that were supposed to be about Haven and Salarian League. But I know there's only so many hours in a day and so many years in a life, unfortunately. So priorities had to be picked.
Right.
Jim, I am going to let you introduce us to the companion section, and I'll let you explain how we're going to do that.
Okay.
Which is a little odd.
So what I asked my colleagues to do was choose a section of the companion to just kind of talk about it a little bit and what they may have gotten summarize. From it. Yeah, summarize it a little bit. And so I'll start out, and I chose pages 206 to 210 in the Kindle edition. And this section of the companion covers the years from 775 to 1542 PD. Sounds like a big chunk, but the sections are kind of small enough and condensed enough to give you the information you might be looking for without having to do a whole lot of extra reading. So first, there is the departure from Earth and the journey to Manticore and the makeup of the colonies that would make the landing. I've always wondered about this, and I've always wondered why we didn't get a novel about this. So it was neat to read it, how this worked out. Then there is a discussion of the landing and establishment of Manticore, which is from 1416 to 1453. The establishment of the colony, the government, and the banking system are discussed in this section. There are also mentions of piracy, which was repealed and stopped thanks to advanced planning. That is followed by a discussion of the plague years, 1464 to 1496. Pathogens naturally present on Manticore combined with human coronaviruses, which caused the deaths of nearly 60% of the original colonists, and jumped to the other planet in the system, Sphinx. The selection, before the establishment of the Royal Manticore Navy, concludes with the founding of the Star Kingdom, 1471 to 1542, followed by the plague. More colonists were needed to maintain a viable colony, but before they brought any more people in, a constitution was established, as well as a constitutional monarchy consisting of the Winton family. Thanks to the lack of enemies and the recruiting of new colonists, the kingdom of Manticore thrived.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, so those sections, the historical sections for me were really neat, and I enjoyed reading those. I do intend to read more from the companion. So how about you, JP?
I'm highlighting a section of the companion called Building a Navy in the Honorverse, and that was pages 441 to 463, also in the Kindle edition. This is an overview or a recap or a summary of what we've learned about the navies we've seen across many of the star nations. This isn't a technical discussion about ship classes, even though ship classes are mentioned, in terms of overall capabilities, why they exist, and their place and strategy. The discussion here is a sort of walk through the Honorverse history, looking at how and why these navies grew into what they were, based on a star nation's requirements for defense, their ambitions, their commerce, etc. The discussion is about all that goes into fielding a credible fleet, specifically including strategic assumptions and goals, fleet mission and design, force size and force management, and those are actually sections inside this essay, if you want to call it that. In that overall context, we then get to see the roles of the various military services, the logic for fleet capabilities, size and mix, brief discussion about super dreadnoughts, battleships, battlecruisers, cruisers, and destroyers was a part of this as well, that gave rough tonnages and those kinds of things. Very cool. The role of energy weapons and missiles is in here, and the advent of missile pods. Logistics are also covered in a brief discussion about the use of fleet stations in the context of the practical laydown of fleet assets across space, whatever that space is. The territory of these various star nations, obviously Manticore. But that was this essay, this section. It was a great section for anyone who has found themselves asking, why is the Navy configured that way in these stories? And one quick example, rolling all that together, are things like the relationship of perhaps the Royal Manticoran Marine Corps or the Army, which is only ever briefly mentioned, to the RMN. All that is those dots are connected in this part of the book. How about you, Raul?
This was actually a hard thing section to pick. I was tempted to do the frequently asked questions, but I'm just going to leave it at, folks, read the frequently asked questions out of House of Steel. It's worth your time. But I ended up going with the Grayson Navy. And yeah, it's basically reading a military history or a text, a reference, or a military reference, which for a lot of us is a lot of fun. One of the things that you don't necessarily think of when you think of Grayson, because you think of it as a back world, you think of it as a backwater that's been forgotten, right? Well, the truth is their Navy dates back to the early 1300s post-diaspora, which grew out of their Grayson Space Guard, which was basically a police and search and rescue operation. But that makes it one of the oldest navies in space, to be honest. They did start upgrading technologically in the later 1800s. But and just all those little details that you find out about that, in addition to things like the organizational structures that JP had mentioned, we get a detailing of the organizational structure as well as the staff that are actually filling the roles at the time. And that's true with the Manticore, the similar section in Manticore as well. I like the detailed history because we see it already, but the Protector Zone Squadron. And then we go into the personnel aspects of it with things like descriptions of uniforms, which seems strikingly more similar to U.S. Air Force than a U.S. Navy uniform in some ways, I think. It might just be the way they use the blues and the jacket and the peaked cap, but a lot of the remaining sections are a breakdown of the Grayson order of battle. And one of the things I especially liked about it is it looks at things pre-alliance and post-alliance. So post-alliance, obviously, what was that, the second or third Honor Harrington book? So you're looking at the early 1900s. And then we're also seeing the ships that they had pre-alliance in the second half of the 1800s. A lot of stuff still using reaction, fusion reaction thrusters. We get a lot into the technology as well, some of the different approaches. Though I'll admit we've seen some of that elsewhere, but their use of fusion and fission, come up into this. But it's putting it in the context of a military reference, which I just thought was really cool. So that's the section that I liked. And there's other, this covers other aspects. It goes into other aspects as well. There's, as JP mentioned, the Manticoran Army. There's a section on the Grayson Army. Backgrounds on the people, the government. It's just a really fun chunk of material for you, anyone who wants more information of how everything's put together and works. So that was my section.
Excellent.
From here, I guess we probably should get into some ratings.
All right. Jim? Yeah, I think so.
Which is a hint. You get to go first.
Yes. I gave this 4 laser-head armed missiles and a ship to carry them.
Nice. Well, I gave it 4 useful technical essays, maybe even in proceedings. Mm. Okay, seriously, though, they were all cool and useful in this book.
Very much so. And for me, it got 4 Black Ops R&D projects, which makes Jim's math very easy.
Yeah, I could do this one in my head. I didn't even have to take my shoes off. Overall, that gives us a 4 out of 5.
4.00 repeating.
Oh, correct. Yeah. And then on Goodreads, they are reporting a 4.05 with 1,176 ratings. And Amazon comes in at 4.3 with 658 ratings. So we're all right in the ballpark there. And do we have any shout-outs?
You know, it's interesting. I don't have any particular shout-outs or email.
Yeah, I didn't either. And I think that's because our last book was brand new.
Yeah. But that said, I do have to say anyone who's on Reddit, who's listening, definitely hop over to there's a subreddit where I'm one of the moderators called r/Honorverse.
Ah.
Me and a couple others have kind of tried to revive it, and it's been one of the sources of some of the comments. And I will say while there are no necessarily show comments, it's been a little more active lately. So there's some active discussion going on there that I think folks would really enjoy.
Excellent. Well, I do have 2 shout outs. One.
Important ones.
Yes. One, I want to send a shout out and a thank you to Mr. Hank Davis of the TPE Network of Fun Yet Informative Podcasts for hosting our show to this point and continuing to host our show into the future as books are released. I also want to send a shout out to our faithful listeners. I'm not going to list names. We would be here all night long doing that. So you know who you are. Thank you for listening. Thank you for commenting. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your corrections.
Right on.
Yes. And other insights that you added to our show. Okay.
And yeah.
And finally, here's the sad part. So get your Kleenex box. Okay. This is the last of our regular monthly releases of the Honorverse today, but do not despair. Our plan is to return as new material is released, starting with the next book, A Call to Deception by David Weber, Timothy Zahn, and Thomas Pope. It will be the 5th book in the Manticore Ascendant series, which is currently available for pre-order and scheduled to be released on July 7th, 2026. Announcements about our coverage of this book will come later. Please watch the Facebook pages for our podcast as we get closer to the release date. This is our plan for any and all future books in the Honorverse. In the meantime, also watch for an announcement of an all-new show we are scheming about.
Scheming?
Yes, we are scheming.
We are scheming.
Yes. Announcements.
I can't ski. My mustache is bushy. It's not a handlebar. I can't twirl it, and you can't scheme if you can't twirl.
I'll send you some wax. All right. You can look up pictures of Raleigh fingers to see exactly how that's supposed to be done. All right. So announcements will also appear on the Honorverse Today Facebook page. So
I do have to add one thing.
I was just going to say, do you have any closing remarks?
Yeah, we also keep an eye open. There very well may be things that come up with the Honorverse that we will be dropping special episodes on. I don't know. I mentioned something about short stories. We don't know what's going to go on with that yet. We would love to get David in for a final chat. So don't shut off your feed or drop the subscription just yet. And this is, as Jim said, also the place you will want to come to for information about our new project to continue the traditions.
Yeah. How about you, JP?
Man, I can't add anything else to all that awesomeness.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, say goodnight, JP.
Good night, JP.
Good night, everybody.
So long, everyone. We'll be right back.
for listening to Honorverse today. We welcome your feedback. Email us at honorverse@tpenetwork.com. We are a proud part of TPE Network. Visit us on the web at honorverse.net, on social media, or tpenetwork.com. You can subscribe to Honorverse today by visiting tpenetwork.com/subscribe. Visit TPE Network for the very best in podcasting. Opinions expressed in the show are solely those of the hosts. They do not reflect the opinions or views of Bain Books, the authors, or TPE Network. Visit Bain.com for the best in science fiction. Many of their books are available from the Bain Free Library found at their site. Theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Valaha. Check his website found in the show notes for all your podcasting music needs.
Three, two, one. There we go. Got to clap.
All right.
Oh, where's my notes?
I don't know.
Right where you left them.
There they are. Ha ha. Oh. You know what?
What?
Oh, never mind. We'll bring it up Thursday. My mind is just bouncing all over the place. I'm sorry, gentlemen.
All right.
I'm recording. I hope you guys are as well.
Yep. Mine's good.
Stop that.
Unless the lights on the box are lying to me, which I doubt they are.
Where's my Zoom fit? Thank you. Hey, at least I got a voice for this recording.
Yeah, there you go.
Unfortunately, I've got a face for radio and a voice for cinema. All right.
Have a voice for pantomime.
That's an even better way of putting it. Am I positioned right? Yes, I am. Got to get that proximity effect, right? But there are two I have to point out, Alexander Hamish and Sonia Hemphill. So, I mean, I love the way it was described. They were best enemies since kindergarten, basically.
You know what, Raul? We're going to go down this road again. Hamish Alexander.
What'd I say?
Alexander Hamish.
All right.
So, tell you what, start that whole section over again, and I'll just turn this into a outtake.